This is the Criminal Law Revision Subcommittee Number 2, Tuesday, September 16, 1969, Room 319, State Capitol Building. Today's subject, perjury and related offenses. Preliminary draft number 1.
We were kind of in the middle.
Pick that for you about Section 7, weren't you, something like that?
We were just beginning to discuss Section 8. Page 30.
Okay. Let's run through for Tom's benefit and for Wally's benefit so I remember what we did.
Do you want to go over the minutes at all?
Yeah, let me do that. Excuse me for not being prepared.
On the minutes would be the
point. Could you do that just?
No.
Starting with Section 1 and.
Well, to recap the sections that we covered in our last meeting, starting with Section 1 on definitions, we made some changes in the definition of sworn statement. We read now, sworn statement means any statement knowingly given under oath or affirmation attesting to the truth of what is stated. Period. Definition of statement remains about the same. There were just some minor changes. The addition, I mean, after any representation was added of fact. Statement means any representation of fact and includes. Definition of material was changed to means that which could have affected the course or outcome of any proceedings or transaction, period. And official proceeding was deleted.
How about the phrase, regardless of its admissibility under the rules?
That was deleted.
Okay.
And on page 7, we had section 2 and section 3, with perjury in the second degree and perjury in the first degree. And those were combined so that we will only have one degree of perjury.
So it now reads, a person commits the crime of perjury in the first degree if he makes a false sworn statement.
In regard to a material issue,
knowing
it to be false. In other words, we got rid of the distinction between perjury in an official proceeding and perjury under oath in situations other than official proceeding.
So false statement is, sworn statement is perjury, period.
In other words, there'll only be one degree of perjury. Section 4, false swearing. That wasn't changed. It just it should be all in one sentence. So
yeah.
A person commits a crime of false swearing if he makes a false sworn statement. Section 5 is on page 18. Unsworn falsification.
Roger, what's the difference between perjury and false swearing then? I'm sorry, take it back to 7.
Materiality.
Same definition.
It's same as present. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On this section 5, we made some changes which were noted in the minutes, but I don't know I think Attorney General Johnson had a change, and then I kind of rephrased it, and I don't know if I've got it down here correctly. I've got, a person commits a crime of unsworn falsification if he makes any false written statement to a public servant in connection with an application for pecuniary or other benefit.
Page 9 of the minutes. Start.
Yeah, it's on page 11.
Yeah, we're about the middle of page.
Oh, I see. You got it. Thank you.
I think what we did was cut out parts of...
We got rid of with the intent to mislead.
We moved that, I think. Didn't we? No, I guess we did take it out. If, yeah, like we did, a person commits a crime of unsworn falsification if he or submits.
Okay. Did you insert to a public servant?
Yes. To a public servant in the performance of his duties. In the performance of his duty.
And then you deleted section 6.
Yes.
Yes.
Section 7 on page 25, the only change I have noted here is that...
Sound equivalent.
Yeah, cross out equivalent on sub 3.
Okay, well...
did you want to approve the minutes or have a motion on those? I think it's on. You didn't get beyond those sections on your...
No, we just started to discuss Section 8, and we adjourned before we came to any decision.
Okay, do you want to move the adoption of the minutes, Mr. Haas?
So moved.
All those in favor of the adoption of the minutes dated July 18, 1969, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Carried. Okay, Section 8. Is a familiar ring to it?
30. Says, no prosecution shall be brought for perjury or false swearing if the substance of the defendant's false statement is his denial of guilt in a previous criminal trial.
What are we talking about? Where the defendant, or where witnesses ask, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And he says no.
No.
We're not getting to that, are we?
It would be in a criminal trial where the answer was went to the core issue of whether he was guilty or not.
He pleads not guilty, but the jury finds him guilty in a previous trial.
Or he takes a stand on his own behalf and he's asked whether or not he did it and he says no.
Yeah.
Comes under the category of enough's enough, I think.
Or a right to lie in one's defense.
Yeah.
That's about it, right.
You can't shed that cloak, can you?
We don't have such a statute, nor are you prepared in time. And the only case that's really at point is State versus Reynolds, where they didn't get to this exact point. They found that his testimony in that case went to a collateral matter to his guilt, and they held that that could be the basis for a later prosecution for perjury.
How would this apply to a person who doesn't make a statement as to guilt or innocence, but gives an alibi, which is whole cloth? How would this section affect that?
I would say an alibi, collateral to whether he's guilty or innocent. You're getting some pretty fine points on trying to determine whether the testimony in question is collateral or whether it goes to the core issue is guilt or innocence.
Well, he says I wasn't there. That's pretty much goes directly to the question of guilt.
Mm-hmm. The Model Penal Code didn't include this provision.
It did not?
No. Michigan did.
If this is Mr. Johnson's notebook, I notice he has it scribbled out rather viciously.
Yeah. Well, I might mention, Mr. Chairman, we discussed this section when Roger was working on it. And I personally don't think much of it, but Roger and I both felt that this was a matter that, you know, should be brought before the subcommittee and let you make a determination on it. The way I look at it, I don't think that this has been a problem in the state of Oregon.
No.
Where you've had a lot of criminal prosecutions that have resulted from, where just based on a man's testifying that he's not guilty, you know.
It would be a rare situation, and a statute like this, in those rare situations, might create more problems than if it's solved. In other words, the determination of whether this statement was collateral or...
All this is essentially trying to do, isn't it, just to prevent the
district
attorney from relitigating the, such as in Tom's example, the issue of alibi. I couldn't get him on this, they bought it, but I don't think a reasonable jury would buy it. This was a bad jury, so I'll indict him for perjury, and we'll at least stick him away for 10 years if we couldn't get him for life.
And this has happened before. Well, maybe not exactly that way, but...
What's wrong with it?
You'll notice on page 31, there are a number of Oregon statutes that grant immunity to testimony of witnesses, but some of them specifically exempt perjury.
But doesn't the statement of a person on the stand saying, I wasn't here, I was in Phoenix, Arizona, run directly to a material issue, and isn't that a fact to lie under oath?
Well, but you're going to hear it. It's submitted to the jury unless he's acquitted.
Well, they may acquit him on an entirely different material allegation.
Yeah, that would be one problem. You're not going to know why he was acquitted.
It would be just my offhand opinion that should be left open to the sound discretion of the district attorney in a given case. I don't believe that we have a history of any abuse in this area that I'm aware of.
Well, that was pretty much my reaction to this. Now, Michigan has this, doesn't it?
Yes. But the weight of authority of the United States would be contrary to this. This isn't a very common type of statute.
I have no strong feelings one way or another. Ken, do you have any?
Do I?
Yeah, any feeling one
After
way or another?
After a great deal of thought, no, I don't.
All right. Earl?
I don't have any strong feeling. I can argue either way.
I'm looking at the minutes. I think the point Roger brought up last meeting was basically the same one he's brought up now, that it's going to make it kind of tough for the court to interpret what is not a collateral matter and what is going to the heart of the matter and to grant the protection. Well, should we get rid of it? I recommend it's removed.
Yeah, you could also look at it this way, couldn't you, that the district attorney's office being surprised would not have adequate opportunity to refute it. Verdict would be in. Subsequently, they've gathered enough evidence to show that it was complete fabrication. And
however, the district attorneys are protected there.
No, but I mean...
because of the recent legislation requiring 5 days notice of alibi.
Yeah.
But there are many other things other than alibi as well.
You're rubbing it in.
Well, Mr. O'Dell for Mr. Johnson suggests we get rid of it, don't you, Tom?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Any disagreement? I'll take it in the form of a motion. We'll just eliminate Section 8. Leave it to the sound judicial discretion of our 36 district attorneys.
Nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan. All right.
Section 9, page 33. The corroboration requirement, perjury and false swearing. No person shall be convicted of the crime of perjury or false swearing except a prosecution based upon inconsistent statements pursuant to Section 10, where proof of falsity rests solely upon the uncorroborated testimony of a single witness. This is, in effect, a reiteration of the existing corroboration rule in Oregon today. There is quite a bit of conflict on this rule among the states. Model Penal Code, their advisory committee recommended eliminating the rule, and that position was supported by the council, but their reporters favored retention of it, and they won out in the end, and it was retained in the Model Penal Code. The commissioners on uniform state laws in the Model Act on perjury eliminated the rule. It has been retained by Michigan and New York. It's the two-witness rule.
The difficult problem with this is there's some conflict as to whether witnesses to what, the perjured statement or the act itself. And that should be clarified if it's in.
Well, it usually is spoken of in terms of just an oath against an oath, that you're going to use circumstantial evidence as evidence of falsity, that the rule doesn't apply. This is worded a little differently in the present Oregon statute. Let's see. Yeah. Which says perjury shall be proved by the testimony of two witnesses or one witness in corroborating circumstances.
Why are we rejecting that? Because of the conforming order of the Model Penal Code?
Well, we're not rejecting it. We're in this section would retain it.
Well, it certainly states it a different way.
Oh, you mean as far as the language
wording,
is concerned?
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I think your quote from Perkins on page 34 at the bottom against me, he suggests that the rule should be limited to the situation for which it was designed, namely to prevent a conviction of perjury where there's no other evidence other than the word of one witness against that of the defendant. It has no place in a case in which the falsity of the defendant's testimony can be established by evidence of other kind. I think that's what you were getting at.
Yes.
I suppose the rule evolved out of the fear of unhappy litigants, didn't it? People being unhappy with someone's testimony that was adverse to theirs, accusing them of lying. I would assume you might find a lot of that in domestic relations.
Well, there apparently is quite a split of authority even now.
There is. On page 35, the policy question to be decided is whether the protection of witnesses counterbalances the occasional inability to convict an apparent perjurer. That comes out of the Michigan commentary, where they say their committee feels that the policy issue should be decided in favor of inducing free witness testimony, and they retained the rule.
Where does section 9, the language from section 9, come from? Well, I'll state my point. I have a lot more difficulty understanding section 9 as it's written, and I do ORS 162, mm-hmm. 160, or the three model penal codes, the Michigan revised or the New York text. They all make more sense to me than the statement of section 9.
Do we have 162 in here?
It's based mostly on,
right under A
on the
summary.
Michigan statute.
Front page.
Michigan, on page 37, 49, 20.
Well, you also added the, you utilized that and you added the provision about inconsistent statements made under oath. You just combined them, didn't you? And all it does.
What's that?
I said it's the same as the present ORS, except that it includes the...
It says the same thing.
It says the same thing,
right.
Except that it includes the fact that sworn inconsistent statements,
yes,
you can go ahead and prosecute.
Yes, well, that was included because we presently have no provision. Perjury provision for inconsistent statements, but we are proposing one.
Yeah.
Now that should refer to section 10, isn't it?
Yeah.
What you're referring to there. Mm-hmm.
Oh, in response to your question, the language instructor is closest to
Michigan.
The Michigan 49-20.
But we put it in the way we're putting most of ours by starting no person, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you might want to take a look at section 10, Mr. Chairman, before you decide what you want to do with 9. See what the provision is with respect to inconsistent statements. This is another section we discussed at some length. felt that the commission should have the opportunity to examine what the different approaches are in this area and make a policy decision. I think this really calls for a fairly fundamental policy decision.
This statute just provides a means of bringing a prosecution for perjury where a person has made two sworn inconsistent statements and you don't know which one's untrue, but obviously one of them is. So if a person has made inconsistent sworn statements, both made within the statute of limitations and within the jurisdiction of this state, it shall not be necessary to allege an indictment or allegation which statement is false. Shall be sufficient to set forth the inconsistent sworn statements and allege in the alternative that one or the other is false and known to be false by the defendant. And two, the highest offense of which a person may be convicted is determined by hypothetically assuming each statement to be false. In other words, if you have different degrees involved, and he can only be convicted of the lesser degree.
That's the kind of cases you like to prosecute, isn't it, Tom?
It's easy to get a prima facie case.
This was not the common law rule.
What's 132.690 say? That's somewhere in here.
Statute on perjury.
Well, 132.690 now reads, in an indictment for perjury or subornation of perjury, it is sufficient to set forth the substance of the controversy or matter in respect to which the crime was committed, in what court or before whom the oath alleged to be false was taken, and that the court or person before whom it was taken had authority to administer it with proper allegations of the falsity of the matter on which the perjury is assigned. But the indictment need set forth neither the pleadings, record, or proceedings with which the oath is connected, nor the commission or authority of the court or person before whom the perjury was committed.
Needless to say, there's been little prosecution under that statute.
Yeah. I'm not sure what that said.
That's why.
Not either.
You sure read well, though, I want you to know.
Make it sound authoritative.
That's right. Scared me. Well, do we have any feelings particularly on inconsistent statements?
Well, they kind of sum it up, I think, on page 46, where they quote Wharton. It said where a defendant has made two distinct statements under oath, one directly the reverse of the other, it's not enough to produce one in evidence to prove the other to be false. That's the policy decision we're making in it.
Mm-hmm.
Stripping of his Fifth Amendment rights.
Been no Oregon cases in point. It's been kind of discussed collaterally a few times, and they usually just refer to the common law rule, which didn't provide this sort of thing.
Are we running any kind of risk in the normal civil matter where litigants frequently are just confused? I mean, I suppose that given the benefit of the doubt, and they telling an investigator one thing and upon reflection something else, or they have a deposition where they state some relatively collateral matter. Is this something that we're now opening up a...
Well, of course, your burden of proof as far as proving the perjury would be the same. Would be the same way as you have in the perjury statute.
I think you still have to show the felonious intent or the knowing, at least knowingly.
Yeah, you're going to have to prove that one of them, that the defendant knew that one of them was false.
You have to prove your scienter, mens
rea. Do you really?
I thought that was the...
In other words, aren't you removed from that burden of proving? In other words, in my deposition I say it was raining. And I think about it, and so I swear that it was raining on that day. Then at the trial, I say, it wasn't raining. Haven't you got me right there?
Well, no, I don't think so, because you'd still have to be able to prove that one of these statements was not only false, as opposed to just an erroneous or mistaken statement, but also that it was known to be false by the defendant.
Or willfully.
Willfully.
Wouldn't we want to include that in subsection 1 under 10?
Don't believe it would
either willfully or knowingly has made.
I feel a little better about it.
I thought we had that in there. We say it shall be sufficient to set forth and allege in the alternative that one or the other is false. And known to be false by the defendant.
But he'd have to know this. One day the deposition would say it's raining, the next time say it's not raining. I know that one of them is false. Can't both be right. But maybe at the time the statement was made, it was known to be false. Well, that's the only way you could interpret it.
Maybe he was under an awning and someone had dropped a water bucket and he thought it was raining. Later on he knew it wasn't.
They're trying to get scienter in it.
I think you'd have to set forth some sort of scienter, and it may be there, by the way, as presently.
Well, maybe there's a better way of saying it. I think that we allege the mens rea there, the element of knowing.
Yeah, you're right. Known to be false.
Known to be false. Of course, I suppose your question as to when he knows it.
I was going to say, are we talking about his knowledge at the time he makes each statement?
Or the false statement, whatever that
is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. It's a false statement you're concerned with.
In other words, the statement you're making at the time, you would have to have knowledge was a false statement
right.
at the time you made it, not later, at some other time.
That's right.
Well, does it do damage to it to just what does it do if we add knowingly after a person, subsection 1, and leave the rest of it as it is? Or after has, I should say.
You're talking about in sub 1?
Yeah,
if a person has
knowingly made. Of course, that didn't really.
You're dealing with two separate events in
a
period of time.
Yeah, I was trying to think if there's any problem. If your false statement is your first statement, and the second statement is truthful but inconsistent. Well, I guess that wouldn't make any difference, because at the time you made the second statement, you would be knowingly making an inconsistent statement.
Well, I think the time is extremely crucial, though. As you say, the first statement you make and it's wrong, but you didn't know it at the time. So then you make a second statement. Then are you getting into the area here, and the other is false?
Well, if you didn't know the first statement was false when you made it, it isn't perjury, even if it were false.
Well, the DA alleges that I made inconsistent sworn statements, sets them forth, draining one ring, and alleges in the alternative that one or the other is false and known to be false by the defendant. When I make the second statement, then
you know it's
even though I'm true, even though that's true, then I know, I've got to know the other one's false.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
I think reasonable people would interpret that as meaning knowing at the time the statement is made, knowing.
You've decided sometime in the interim that
the first
statement was wrong.
I mean, yeah, it was false, or presumably, let's assume the honesty of the matter and try not to protect the guy's lying at both ends. But
well, of course, that situation shouldn't be perjury in any event. If you didn't have knowledge that your first statement was false at the time you made it.
Well, yes, but
I don't know, is that clear here?
Well, that's what we don't have in here, that at the time he made the statement,
yeah.
You know, to be false.
Just known to be false for the statement, that means known at the time it
he
was
made.
He
made the false statement.
Fine. Say that one or the other is false and was known to be false for the statement by the defendant when made.
Mm-hmm. This Arizona statute is kind of interesting to comment on that on page 43. says that prosecution need not show which one was true or false. That's all it says, apparently. And then the accused is permitted to assert as an affirmative defense that at the time he made each statement, he believed it to be true. It appears to shift the burden of proof to the prosecution and may be objectionable on this ground.
I'd say it does.
After hours, Portland ordinance. Illegal to be on the street without a lawful purpose and disclosing the same. That type of thing.
With one or both partially or wholly exposed.
Well, any...
That's a problem. That's a problem.
Any particular feelings? Do we want to patch it or do we want to junk it? Or leave it as is?
We don't have... Is this right? We don't have anything on this now.
No, you couldn't you couldn't bring an indictment or perjury now on the basis of inconsistent statements.
If there were depositions taken in a criminal case and a witness testified... all this does, as in essence, is just provide a tool to the district attorney, isn't it?
Right. We don't.
I mean, you can prosecute that guy now for making a false statement
or perhaps perjury if it's material.
Yeah.
Can't be. But
you've got to prove that it's false.
Witness State versus Chapano, a case I tried, which I finally ended up getting thrown out of court because I just didn't have enough law. I had plenty of facts. This is exactly what was needed in that case.
How so, Tom?
You had two sworn statements or testimony?
In direct opposition.
You know damn well one of them's a lie, which you can't prove which one.
And he couldn't get a conviction?
No, Judge Woodridge dismissed.
You appeal that, Tom?
That's something else we should do.
Don't talk to him about it.
Well, it seems to me this is a desirable statute, would be. I don't think it's unfair on the defendant in a situation like this where, you know, I don't think a defendant should be allowed to have it both ways, you know. And
well, yes, but it's one thing if you're talking about it being in a big criminal trial, but this would be true in any situation. This would be true in a civil trial. Where you have somebody, you know, it offends me to the attorney, maybe it's my pristine attitude, but the attorney that you realize, Mr. Jones, you're under oath for the benefit of the jury. Of course he's under oath.
Well, of course, but this still, even this this sanction would not destroy the discretion of the district attorney to decide what perjury cases he's going to go on and which he isn't.
Shouldn't a person be required to give a little explanation when they've got two sworn statements under oath directly opposite of one another given within this period of time? I mean, you know.
One criticism of this rule by some people is that it might encourage consistency more than truth. In other words, if you lied the first time, you're going to have to lie this time too, even though you would prefer to tell the truth.
Well, isn't this just a matter of, this is a procedural amendment rather than any substantive amendment?
It's a prima facie situation.
Yeah,
we're saying
that
the state, by proving the two inconsistent statements,
doesn't have to go further.
I think that's what we're saying.
In essence, that's what it says.
In other words, just introduce the two depositions or the transcript and the deposition or whatever and rest your case.
Yeah, you just allege in the alternative. You allege that they're each false and known to be false to the defendant. You're going to be right on one of them.
One might qualify that somehow, the wording I don't have, but have the knowingly run to the false statement, whether it be the first or second.
Mm-hmm.
How that would be worded, I don't know.
Well, I'm worried about the second sentence. Yeah. The second sentence is it just a matter of pleading? So I think perhaps we ought to direct ourselves at the first sentence of section one, which apparently is the crime. No, that's just pleading too. Mm-hmm. It's just pleading. Or proof, burden of proof statute, I guess you'd say.
Might possibly kind of be worrying about something that's not a problem because I think that the general principles of criminal law would know that knowingly had to run to the false statement. I don't see that.
At the time it was made.
At the time it was made, yes.
Well, if you're satisfied with that, I won't because it's hard to write in the knowingly, but as long as we're clear that we're not going to get the guy caught up in an inconsistency, that he now recognizes his first statement is false, admits the falsity of the first statement because he was mistaken, and then has to face some sort of a charge with the DA just proving the inconsistency. The DA would still have to prove that at the time he made the statement, he knew it was false. And he can't pull himself up by the bootstraps by just introducing the two, saying, well, you know, you made them both. One of them's got to be false. That's the thing that frightens me, that we just leave it at that.
Well, that could be clarified in the second sentence of sub one.
Mm-hmm. You could just add right after defendant, at the time the defendant made the false statement.
Or you could allege this, that shall be sufficient, or you could state it this way, it shall be sufficient to set forth the inconsistent sworn statements and allege in the alternative that the defendant knowingly made the false statement.
But of course, doesn't that put you right back in perjury and more or less take out the effectiveness of the statute? This recommendation?
What do we mean by in the alternative there, Tom?
Either one or the other is false.
Okay.
That's the crux of it, right? Well, what you're trying to lessen the burden of proof on the DA, all he has to do is, rather than prove the falsity of either statement, the fact he's got the two inconsistent statements, and then he just has to prove knowingly made, and he can rest.
But I suppose the argument could be raised that even though you don't say so in so many words, that this shifts the burden. This shifts the burden to the defendant
of going forward.
Yeah.
Perhaps,
so. Yeah. Just
yes.
He can rest on his rights.
I would think, though, you'd have to have more than just, as a practical matter of prosecution, you're going to have more than just the two inconsistent statements. You're going to have to be able to show circumstances surrounding at least one of them to be false to have a beyond the reasonable doubt question, I think.
I don't think with this you would. No, but that's what you've got now. I mean, that's what you indicated was a problem.
It says there's some protection provided for the innocent victim of inconsistent statements. The prosecution cannot rely solely upon the introduction of two inconsistent statements. It must also prove that the defendant could not have honestly believed each statement to be true when made.
Where does it say that?
Page 40.
No, I know, but where does it say that in section 10? What drives the comment to think, where does the comment see that?
Well, he has to allege that one of the others is false and known to be false for the defendant, so if he alleges it, he's going to have to prove it.
Yeah, you're going to have to prove the falsity, the knowing of the false statement, whether it be one or two, under the way it's presently alleged. That's what I mean. You're going to need more than just two inconsistent statements.
You don't think that my suggestion here that it was raining, it wasn't raining, now you know, Mr. O'Dell, that one of those statements is false? Yes, I know one has to be false.
But at what point did you know it was false when made? First we have to determine which one is false, I suppose.
I just think the only virtue in this thing is when it works too slick is the thing that bothers me. When it really will help the DA is a situation where he cannot prove, he wasn't there, he can't prove whether it was raining that day or not, but he's got this guy because he's got him under oath saying that one time it was raining, one time it wasn't.
And there should be an explanation for that type of conduct.
Yeah, I'd agree with you too on that, Earl, but I...
Don't you think, again, that you have to rely somewhat on the general thumb, the discretion of the grand juries and the various district attorneys to bring these in cases where it's obvious the prosecution should ensue rather than just every false statement? Believe me, I have district attorneys are too busy around the state than to go around looking in domestic relations cases and to try to bring these things up. The only danger that I can see with this slick statute is where you get two very antagonistic litigants, who one of whom may bring pressure or something of this sort. But this is also true of the statutes you now have in perjury. It can still be brought. I don't believe that we make it any easier.
Yeah, but this is the point, that at the present time, let's suppose you had two inconsistent statements, Tom. How would you, in a given case, you would try to find which one was false, and then charge him with perjury, indict him on perjury, and allege that at the time he made the statement he knew it was false, under oath or whatever the case may be, and try him on that. You'd prove, one, that it was false, and two, that he knew it. Those are the two. Okay, you got perjury. Now this, if this is going to be any help, if you knew which one was false, and you could prove it, you wouldn't need this statute. So the only time it's going to be a help is when you don't know the facts.
And one of them has
and to. Can't prove the facts.
That's the thrust of the... Of
therefore, you can't go beyond this, really. Or it's not, I mean, if you're able to prove any more than just the inconsistency, document A, document B, if you're able to prove, you don't need this. You can go beyond.
Yeah. That's true, and any amendment to it would simply just be putting a second perjury statute
in
the book.
Yeah.
Well,
you don't agree?
Not really, but, you know, maybe this might be more palatable if, and I think Roger's early rough draft, you had a section on retraction, didn't you?
Yeah. It's back here.
Is it still in this draft?
No,
I discussed retraction. I discussed why it wasn't included in the article. On reflection since, I don't know if I would, from what I've read and thought about retraction since, might be advisable to just have such a section.
The Michigan committee seemed to feel that there wasn't any point in retaining the common law rule, which is that would prevent conviction just on proof of inconsistent statements, because they'd included in their code a section on retraction, and that this gives a guy an out if at the time of the trial.
Yeah, but you might turn to, just to compound the problem, we're on 10 so we can more understand 9, so let's turn to page 38 and look at retraction so we can a little better understand 10. The retraction, I think this is, you talk about providing the court with a difficult determination to make on some of these other things. When is the course of the proceeding such that it became manifest?
Yeah, well, that was the main problem I found with
it. Look out, here it comes.
This is the reason we no longer have a contributing statute, because it manifestly tends the same type of vagueness.
I'm not too impressed by the retraction. I'd agree with Roger's first conclusion. How do the rest of you feel? I don't know if you had a chance to study it. But
of course, Michigan didn't have that kind of language in it. Michigan states, no person shall be convicted of perjury if he retracted his false statement in the course of the same proceeding in which it was made.
Mm-hmm. That tightens that some.
Yeah, you don't have that.
Well, that'd be good. You have it in a rebuttal right at the end. Everybody retracts all the false statements they've made.
That's the other way, yeah.
I think when they say he, I think they mean he personally.
Oh, I thought maybe it was
rather than his attorney.
I thought maybe it would be an absolution pronounced. I state before all the witnesses appear on behalf that defendant now retract all the false statements made before the court.
I think that I have a motion.
Please.
I move we strike 10. And, it just seems to me that it is, we're talking about policy here, and that. And that it does have a goes in the direction of putting a person under considerable pressure to make doggone sure his statements are inconsistent, are consistent even though untrue. And we should all it does, if we kick it out, it just require the district attorney to prove which one was untrue. And it seems to me that burden should fall in the face of encouraging witnesses to tell the truth in the final analysis on the stand, even though if it means testifying directly opposite to what they have before.
Any other comments, Ken? How do you feel? Tom?
I feel that it's a valuable statute if it can be worked out. I think it's needed. It's a common occurrence, particularly in criminal cases where we have wide degrees of inconsistent statements flying in the face of each other, and I think it's a valuable tool. I would suggest as an alternative, perhaps, if Dewey, rather than striking it, then to limit it to criminal proceedings.
Well, this is one thing
that's
in my mind.
That worries me even more, though. You know, because, I mean, you go down as a DA, and let's say you got a deposition of a witness. And the trial's going along, he's getting his time. Actually, someone telling him that, you know, because we're always worried about it. Stick with your story, baby. Getting better, you know, you're always worried about that in any type of trial. Is the witness gonna, they gonna waver? And boy, you know, if you say, if you change.
I gotcha.
All we gotta do is just show you changed your story here today. And man, I think that if the person really felt that maybe they really wanted to change their story, I mean, an honest conviction that maybe it wasn't the way they said it was, they'd be very hesitant to do so.
Do you think they would be any more so than under existing law, where, I mean, you're not concerned about the person who's mistaken or doesn't remember? Or
well, if I was advising him, I would. I mean, if I were his lawyer, the witness lawyer, I'd say, well, let me tell you what they got to do. You might as well know this. Show you said this in the deposition and this today, and that's an indictment.
Could be.
Yeah,
but the state's still going to have to prove that you knew it to be false. I mean, this doesn't eliminate that requirement.
Well, how do they prove it?
I think that's right, and that gets back again to. And that's the basic policy question.
How do they prove it? You knew the statement's false?
Yeah, because somebody, how do you prove, how would you, Tom,
same way you do in any case.
In this instance, I've apparently, you introduced both statements at that
and that's it.
Is sufficient. In the course of the perjury matter, you either have a witness corroborated or two witnesses to the act testified about, not the testimony itself, is the way I interpret it.
Yeah.
And
so, but here again, the benefit of this then is the fact that all you introduce is the two inconsistent statements.
Well, no, but you can also have circumstantial evidence which would tend to show that the defendant must have known this was a false statement.
What I'm trying to say is, in order to convince a jury, you're going to have more than just two inconsistent statements. I can visualize too many defenses to that if that's all you have.
Then why have this then?
All this does, this just takes the state out of the dilemma of having to decide which one of these statements right. He's going to go on. I don't think that's unfair.
I don't think we should overlook the fact that we have two opposed inconsistent statements under oath, and this is a serious business.
What would happen if, say, a criminal knew that he was had and he purposely made two inconsistent statements? Then maybe the third one might be the truth.
I can't see where this would benefit him. For just an example, I'm presently working on a murder case where I have 14 statements from one person, all under oath, all inconsistent.
Would this be of any help, too?
Bound to be a woman.
You could allege all 14.
In the alternative.
Multiple counts, seven counts.
If we look on page 44, after having discussed most of this in the commentary, it says, is there then a legitimate goal other than to compel witnesses to tell consistent stories? And Judge Hand in the Buckner case says there is. Namely, to make it possible to submit to the jury a case where a declarant has made contradictory statements under circumstances strongly suggesting that one or the other was willfully false. Each statement must be treated as an isolated possible offense, charged in separate counts, subject to judicial compulsion on the prosecutor to elect which county to proceed before he can go to the jury. Consideration of the case is unrealistically compartmentalized.
Now, what if we change? We got a motion to delete it before. So what if we changed the second sentence, sub 1, to it shall be sufficient to set forth the inconsistent sworn statement and allege the alternative, legend prove, you know, allege the alternative that one or the other is false and was known to be false at the time made by the defendant. It was made by the defendant.
Known to be false when made by the defendant.
Was known by the defendant to be false.
It,
is that what you
when
mean?
Made, yeah. I, as I say, and I, you just call it a slick, I don't mean to be cute on it, but I think it draws its great benefit from being able to assist the prosecution in shifting the burden, really, is what it is, making the defendant explain why.
Well, as a practical matter, though, in criminal prosecution, when you prove your case, prima facie case, have evidence on all your material allegations, you, in effect, have shifted the burden anyway, unless he wishes to avoid conviction. I don't care what the crime is.
Yeah.
And there would be no more in this case.
Well, I'd be inclined at least to leave it into the temporarily until we get to the full committee. If we could beef up that thing so that it's that you can't just nail him on inconsistent statements and one, prove it's false because they're inconsistent, and two, prove that he had to know that one of them was false because they are inconsistent.
Has to know that one or the other is false, some other amendment of that sort.
At the time made. Because if you still have to prove that he had knowledge, of course, if you could prove he had knowledge that it's false, you're right back where you were.
It was false.
Here's what might be a suggestion. To set forth the inconsistent sworn statements and allege in the alternative that the defendant knew one or the other to be false when given. Now that...
Well, he had known the second one was...
No.
Second one
could
be
one
or the other to be false when given. Now he just switches it around, but I think it states it a little more clearly.
Don, what do you think? You're fighting for this.
Well, I think this, that either language such as Tom suggested, I think that would cure it. I think the way it's alleged, the way it's set out here now, actually is more defense oriented than either the New York or Michigan or Model Penal Code, where they talk about, New York says perjuriously made, but the Model Penal Code says all you require there is and not believed by the defendant to be true, which would be a less burden than showing that he knew it to be false.
Yeah, that kind of situation where he didn't know one way or another.
Well, for instance, under the New Jersey Penal Code, they said on page 48 that proof that both statements were made under oath, this is what the DA proved, both statements were made under oath, duly administered, prima facie evidence that one or the other is false. Then, this is Tom's point, and if the jury are satisfied from all the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that one or the other is false and that such false statement was willful, it should be sufficient for a conviction.
Well, let me ask Tom. You've got the situation where you've got the depot, sworn statement, and you've got the sworn statement in court, and they're directly contradictory. And you say, son of a gun. And you go down and you allege the crime the way it is here. And you go up and you start your case, and you introduce the deposition, and you introduce the transcript of the court proceeding, those statements, and they are directly contradictory, and you rest, and the defense gets up, and what, moves to dismiss?
Because we haven't proven willfulness
or
substantial falsity in one place or the other. I think we've got a prima facie case.
That's what I thought.
However, isn't it a fact also that any lawyer worth his salt, or any lawyer period, let's put it that way, having a deposition of his client or of the adverse witness in the civil case is going to impeach him because of the prior inconsistent statement. And isn't that person at that time going to say, yes, but I was mistaken and I now recall, and doesn't that take it out of this section of statute?
You're requiring him to testify.
No, I'm talking
I don't think you'd walk away without putting your client on in that circumstances, I think.
What I'm talking about, though, is that the, let's say, the deposition and the civil case outside of the impending criminal. At the trial of the case where the witness testifies contrary to his deposition, isn't the opposing party going to impeach him because of that contrary statement, or isn't his own lawyer going to give him a chance to explain away that inconsistency and thereby have a defense built in under oath explaining the mistake? I mean, as a practical operation, people out in the vineyards work that way, I think. I think that we might be reading too much hazard into this. What it's really meant to, designed to take care of are those people who have given a statement under oath deposition, and then when they see the consequences to someone that they are close to or they have made up with now, are no longer enemies, take the stand and lie. And if you can't really prove the falsity of that statement made in the oath of trial, you then have the inconsistency.
Yeah, I think we're talking about situations where your perjury is almost always going to be on the second statement rather than the first statement.
Very likely.
What draws you to that?
I can argue the other way. Said it when they were mad at him to get him, and now they're not mad at him.
They said it when they liked him to help him, and now they're mad at him.
Well, just by trying to determine what would motivate a person to perjure themselves under oath in the first place.
Money.
Pride. Anything. Were you there? No, I wasn't there. Maybe you get somebody.
It's 20 years, might.
Reading the old statute might bring you around.
Well, I'd like to restate my earlier suggestion on this. Now, I think that from the standpoint of alleging the requisite culpability on the part of the defendant, that our definition of knowingly, as we've defined it in the article on culpability, would get to that. And I thought language like this might do it, that shall be sufficient to set forth the inconsistent sworn statements and allege in the alternative that one or the other is false and that the defendant knowingly made the false statement. Now,
yeah, but
take a look at knowingly.
How do you prove that? When you yourself don't know which one is false, how do you prove that he knowingly made a false statement?
You're arguing with the concept of requiring someone to prove perjury under Section 10 was not designed to do that. It's to prove inconsistency. And
I'm arguing if we get this statute too detailed, we've blown it.
I agree.
In other words, it's got to be slick, boom, boom, on and off, like you put it out. In other words, you come in, here's the two statements. The very fact they're inconsistent proves false and also is evidence for the jury to believe that one of them was willfully false.
It's evidence on the issue of falsity.
Yeah.
But it's not conclusive.
No, but it's prima facie.
It's prima facie.
And like you say, I think in Harold's question, that if all you do is bring in, introduce the documents and rest, and I think if the defendant then doesn't come forward to explain,
sharpen your fangs for cross-examination.
Not necessarily true, because there are other statutes that just by virtue of proving the content of the statute makes it prima facie. For the best example is 0.15 blood alcohol. Prima facie, just go and prove 0.15, the fact he was driving on a public highway and rest. Sure win a lot of cases that way. None. You've got to prove other things. You've got to prove the fact that he was drinking, staggering, and vomiting, and cursing. The mere fact the statute gives you something that makes prima facie case look easy doesn't make the trial of the case easy.
Now you see, now our definition of knowingly is knowingly or with knowledge when used with respect to conduct or to a circumstance described by a statute defining a crime means that a person acts with an awareness that his conduct is of a nature so described or that a circumstance so described exists. So knowingly here would imply that
he knew it was false when he said it. Yeah. Okay, I'll withdraw my original motion and move Don's amendment.
Would you restate the amendment so that we have it clearly in mind, Don?
Yeah, it would be in subsection 1 of section 10. After in the last line, that one or the other is false, and then the new language would be that the defendant knowingly made the false statement.
Okay.
Instead of the, how about a?
Why?
No, I think you're talking about the here in this case, aren't you?
Well, it seems to me that we've got to direct it to
the defendant.
To the, you know, if you've, got, if you've got two statements and you allege one or the other is false, then it's that false statement that you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, what all I'm saying is it may, this may possibly require the state then to identify and prove a false statement. We're back to the same thing as perjury. Made a false statement would mean, would leave you a little more leeway.
Well, you're going to prove they were both made, though.
Well, my object would be to soften the burden of the state by leaving either one of them open rather than focusing the attention on the false statement, a false statement.
Wherever it might be.
How about
be.
Such false statement?
I go for that.
That bails you out.
Well, it's not good draftsmanship, though, frankly. I think that such really doesn't say anything that the doesn't. And it's...
Well, it does in this case. Because such, in the alternative, that one or the other is false. And when you do put here, and that he knowingly made the statement that was false.
Well, he's knowingly he's made both of them. You're just putting a presumption here. So you're presuming when you make two and they're under oath and they're inconsistent that one's false.
Well, you'd, to be grammatically correct, you'd have to say such a false statement, wouldn't you? Isn't a implied when you say such in that manner?
Well, I know the drafting tendency is to get away from suches. And
such is sort of like said in an indictment or something, you know.
Of course, the thing is, people argue that said isn't definitive, then they put a the in there, or that, or those, which is ridiculous, because that can refer anything. Technically, the said refers to whatever he used it with last time. Said contract only refers to the contract, but the contract would refer to any contract.
But here, we're saying that there is a false statement here someplace, and that the defendant made the false statement knowingly.
That's
so it seems to me that the answers it, you couldn't be talking about any other false statement. Whereas I'm not so sure you could say the same thing for the use of a.
I know you could.
And that's what you want.
I have no objection to the.
Now let's leave the and we're going to be. Okay. Mr. Haas has moved the amendment to subsection 1 of section 10. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed nay. Carried. Anything else on section 10? All right, Mr. Haas moves the adoption of section 10. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Carried.
Go back to 9.
Yeah. Does anybody want to bring in retraction? Because we're thumbing back through it. If not, we'll leave it buried. Back to 9.
Really too bad we don't have something like that, though.
Retraction?
Yeah. It's something, certainly.
As a matter of fact, most of the recent revisions have it. Michigan, Illinois, New York.
This the way we're going now. The guy testifies under oath that he wasn't with the defendant, and that he had reason to do that. We're just saying, boy, we're tightening it up. You're placing a premium on consistency, the first statement, and seems to me it'd be nice if we had something where he can have an out by going in and retracting and then testifying. Don't you think, Tom?
Well, I agree. It takes the accent off of you better be consistent whether you're true or not, yeah. Type attitude. But if you put the retraction statute in, what have you really done? I mean, so far as passing the section 10 to begin with, you make Section 10 ineffective by a person's ability to recant, and then tell a false story, or an inconsistent or false story at Section 10.
Except that, I don't know anything about the retraction statutes. I presume that, do they make the retraction in open court?
It has to be during the same proceeding that the false statement was made, isn't it?
I know. Imagine they're going to have to say something. I mean, they just can't say, I want to retract that. I mean, they're going to have to explain it, aren't they? Does the retraction statute give them, it doesn't give them carte blanche immunity from prosecution for perjury, does it?
Yes, it does. If it was in compliance with the retraction statute. For example, the model penal code says no person shall be guilty of an offense under the perjury, law of perjury, if he retracted in the course of the proceedings in which it was made.
Like during the trial?
Yeah.
Or during the deposition?
Then, as I say, these other states have, a number of other states have these, they're all worded a little differently. Like Illinois, where the contradictory statements are made in the same continuous trial. An admission by the offender in that same continuous trial of the falsity of a contradictory statement shall bar prosecution under any provisions of this code.
Well, with no strong feelings on my own, let's go to 9. Perjury and false swearing.
Section 9 is the corroboration rule. Policy question, how much proof do you want to require for conviction on perjury?
Are you satisfied with the, Roger, with the statement? It reads a little harsh to me. No person shall be convicted of the crime of perjury or false swearing except for prosecution. Now, shouldn't except refer to person? Unless you say except in a prosecution? Or except.
Yeah. Except in a prosecution, I would think.
Or during, or except for inconsistent statements.
Number 10.
Because I think, as you said, you took that from the Michigan, but that starts out in any prosecution
right.
for perjury or false swearing, except a prosecution based on, they're talking about prosecutions. Mm-hmm. We start out talking about people and wind up talk about prosecution.
Yeah, it should be amended.
Are we starting everything with no person? Is that, I asked you that once and I think
We're starting all of our definitions of crime with no person. We don't have to use that form necessarily for a provision like this.
I'd be inclined to go, if we're taking it primarily from the Michigan, I think, didn't you say that?
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation would be that we go back and just start it out by saying
in prosecution.
For perjury is false swearing, except a prosecution based upon inconsistent statement pursuant to Section 10, falsity of a statement may not be established solely through contradiction by the testimony of a single witness. That makes a heck of a lot more sense to me than the way it's written.
Were you reading that, or were you?
Yeah, page 37, the middle section, 4920 of text of the Michigan Revised Criminal Code, and I can understand that one, but I was having trouble with Section 9. So they say the same thing; it's just a little grammatical change. Well, do we buy the idea that? You ought to be able to, you must have the
corroboration
of a second witness or circumstantial evidence or something, is that?
I think even prosecutors buy that. It's a,
you think?
It's an excellent out when you have these contentious litigants and they're screaming for something and you say, okay, bring me two people that can do it. You're out of the woods.
Are you satisfied that it's not the proof of the statement made, but the proof of the falsity of the statement made?
Well, it's proof of the falsity of the statement made based upon proof of the act to which it refers.
Yeah,
this is the
that's better said. Well, Ken, do you want to move then the substitution of the words?
On page 37, section 4920?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, and actually that would be deleting the words, no person shall be convicted of the crime of perjury or false swearing, we substitute in any prosecution for perjury or false swearing, right?
Well, we just, we take section 4920 of the Michigan Code just about verbatim, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be verbatim, right. Substituting 10 for 4915. Okay, all those in favor of the substitution as outlined in Ken's motion, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Ken, do you then move the adoption of section 9 as amended?
I sure do.
Yeah, boy. All those in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Carried.
Now, do I understand that you're all agreed that we don't require a retraction?
That's my feeling. Harley has got
I like feeling to say something on it.
I don't want to move on if we want to press it, but I...
And excuse my ignorance, but in present law, there's no way that a person can retract a prior statement? I can see where somebody under duress or something all of a sudden might make a false statement and later want to retract it.
The question is, in my mind, and that's what this discussion here says, that to leave out retraction, it tends to encourage false swearing, perhaps.
Or encourages those who have falsely sworn to now tell the truth.
But my feeling is this.
It's according when they lie.
it depends on whether they admit that the first one was a lie. Because if it's not a lie, if it's not knowingly made, if you're mistaken, then of course you can retract it. So retraction works in such a situation where you say, knowing that it was not raining, you say it was raining. And then for some reason later in the same proceeding you decide, whoop, I better cleanse my soul on this one. I said it was raining and I knew it was not. I retract that statement. You can't get me for perjury.
How would this work with the deposition? And
it'd have to
be
the
retract the deposition at trial.
There's several statutes on it. One of them comments on that point, and they say it's the same proceeding. You know, you can do it later. It would be considered the same proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
If you could do a retraction within the deposition itself, it wouldn't be too objectionable. But retraction later on is where you encourage. It encourages false statement as much as it protects against it. I mean, as much as the other side.
Cuts both ways. Cuts both ways.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin, the problem, that it encourages a person to lie in hopes that they won't be found out. But if it looks like they're going to be found out, they've got it now. That's all they have to do.
I retract that other one, and now
in answer to your question, Senator Jernstein, there isn't anything in our present law to prevent a person from retracting a perjured statement, nor would there be anything if we don't have some specific provision to prevent such a retraction.
But they could be prosecuted.
Right. There's nothing to prevent the district attorney from then prosecuting.
Oh, yeah, they could still be prosecuted, although I would think they'd take a lot of the sting out of it if they did retract, to say the least.
Yeah. But what if they went the other way?
Prosecutors are warm human beings.
Yeah, but what if the prosecutor had the statement his way, and then they get there and they retract and go the other way? The prosecutor is different.
The warmness is drained out of the prosecutor.
The milk of human kindness coddles at that point. Curses.
Coddles I like better.
Unless you're a warm district attorney. Well, I'll say third time a charm. Unless somebody wants to move the adoption and force it to a vote, I'll move on.
I think it's something that we should bring up at the full commission meeting.
Well, of course, I didn't even draft a section on it, so we really, other than I just quoted the model penal code here.
Well, let's do this. Carl, why don't you be a subcommittee of one, a sub-subcommittee of one, to when we get to...
Bring it up. Okay.
Explain your feelings and we can all have at it. We'll let it rest there for the moment. Section 11.
Very long. Section 50. rendering a false report. A person commits the crime of rendering a false report if, knowing or having reason to know it to be false, he, one...
Just a minute, I think your comma there, I think it's typo here. I think that the comma should be after false, if you're going to have it any place.
I mean, after... the,
and not after no, in your third line there. Shouldn't it?
You shouldn't have a comma there. Knowing or having reason to know it to be false.
And then have the comma following false.
Right.
Right.
Well, it would still be after no, too, right?
No.
If?
Comma. Knowing or having reason to know it to
be maybe
false.
Not after if.
If knowing, comma.
Yeah, if knowing, comma, or having reason to know, comma.
It to be false. Know it to be false, comma.
Comma. He, yeah. That's the way I'd read it. Because then you'd read it, rendering a false report, mm-hmm. if knowing it to be false, he, or if having reason to know it
having
to
reason.
Be false, mm-hmm. he. So
that's
I can
what I mean.
Strike the first comma after if.
The one after no.
Yeah.
After no, leave that one in.
Well, what we're doing is setting off or having reason to know.
Yeah.
Because we're saying, if knowing it to be false, but we've added, or having reason to know. So I guess there'd be a comma after knowing and a comma after no.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because of the if.
And then it'd have to be a comma after false.
Right.
Gosh, we reached agreement. Did Eric press on?
That's a lot of commas.
Well, I think it's too many. But
yeah,
I sense that. Yes. You always have final say. You're in charge of typing up the final draft. Watch it, guys, when it comes out.
Count the commas.
Well, we'll tidy that up later.
Okay, sub one, we've only got one comma here, contentment. If he intentionally causes a false alarm of fire or other emergency to be transmitted to an official or volunteer fire department, comma, or to any other government agency that deals with emergencies involving danger to life or property. Or, sub two, gratuitously reports or causes to be transmitted to any law enforcement officer or agency false information relating to A, an actual offense or incident, or to the alleged implication of any some person therein, or B, an alleged offense or incident which did not in fact occur, or 3, an alleged impending offense or instance which in fact is not about to occur. Well, what we're talking about here, number one, is false fire alarms or other agencies that deal with emergencies, and two, false reports to law enforcement.
What's A? How do we... what's A, Roger? I see, if he transmits a...
false information.
On an actual offense
or incident.
Or... Right, there, it actually happened, and he gives false information about it. Is that right?
Right.
Or... he falsely implicates some person in it.
Mm-hmm.
So part A is where the incident actually occurred, mm-hmm. but he gives false information or implicates falsely another person.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you use the word gratuitously in the second paragraph? Do you mean voluntarily or do you mean truly gratuitously without reward?
I think it means voluntarily. It doesn't have anything to do with economics.
Yeah.
Why do we need it?
Yeah, that's... And then also, under A, do you really mean alleged implication? How does one...
Well, he is alleging someone is implicated.
Yeah, well, yep, but then it would be falsely alleges implication.
Falsely accuses.
Or falsely accuses,
false
and doesn't... And we have him giving false information relating to an alleged implication.
It's extremely difficult to draw an indictment.
That's so remote that it would seem to me that what we want to get him for is giving false information relating to an actual offense or incident, or making a false implication, or falsely accusing.
Or falsely implicating some person.
Or falsely implicating some person,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, that's New York language, isn't it?
That's where
you got it. Yeah, they really, boy, they have a lot of...
They got Cuba and Africa and India, too.
Yeah, they really have a lot of unnecessary language. I have a feeling that that whole section could be condensed to say the same thing.
Don, didn't we, someplace else, I've been over this once before, something else, because we added it, somebody gave the example of the cars on the Clackamas River. Somehow we had the example of somebody reporting that a car had gone into the Clackamas River and a search was initiated for it. Maybe, no, I guess that was during the session. I guess that was one of the bills we had during the session. That's what it was. Don Clark came in on a bill on trying to get false reporting because they spend so much of their time. That's what it was. They spend so much of their time going around trying to...
The go-go dancer for the next...
Do the Federals have a statute on this, such as false reports and bombs and airplanes? Is there a model or something? Is this so forth?
Canada has quite a statute on that. They have, it's a 5-year penalty felony. False reports to police.
Isn't an official fire department, isn't a volunteer an official fire department? I didn't know we had official and unofficial.
Depends on whether, as I understand it, whether you're under a fire control district.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
Like North Powder wouldn't be an official one. There's a lot of volunteers there.
It's interesting. Do we want to be this broad? We got them on fire alarms, training a false alarm, or other emergency. Or reporting to any law enforcement officer or agency false information.
This is the Grenfell Amendment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing when you're talking about the law enforcement area that you have to be rather careful because they ask a great many questions during their investigations.
It would seem to me that would be more alarm than report.
You mean the offense itself? We're talking about false alarms rather than false reports.
Right.
Well, I do think that probably makes more sense in connection with the fire alarms, at least. I don't know about reports to the police.
To me, that's an alarm.
What if he calls the police and gives a... false fire alarm. Is he covered under one?
Police gives a false fire alarm.
No, in other words, we say he has to call either the official or the volunteer fire department. Suppose he calls the cops and says, we got a fire.
Yeah, that would be covered because it's after that he causes it to be transmitted.
To an official.
Mm-hmm. You could tell another person if you knew that that person was... You could ask another person to make a report for you. We have a statute on fire departments now, and it calls it false alarms. No person shall wantonly and maliciously transmit or cause to be transmitted by any means a false alarm of any emergency to any municipal fire department or rural fire protection district within the state of Oregon.
Why didn't we use those words?
Well,
I just think I'm...
Well, for example, we aren't really using the terms wantonly and maliciously.
No, I'm saying, I'm nitpicking on you, Roger, but I'm still not satisfied either though Tom and Don obviously know more than I know. Tom knows a lot more about North Powder than I do, halfway in some of those big areas over there. Somebody ought to check...
As far as municipal fire department or rural fire protection district, that might be the language we should use in Oregon.
That's the only thing I was thinking.
On rural, municipal, rural, or volunteer.
I just don't know that volunteer is, I know we have volunteer fire departments and we have employed fire departments, but I don't know that that's an official designation.
But it would, to me, it would be just as important whichever if some logging company has their own equipment and somebody turns in a false alarm to them. You want to cover those guys too, don't you?
Well, that's the question. Is it the false alarm to whomever it's made?
Right. That's what I...
Or is it just calling out the police and the fire department in the first aid that we were worrying about?
What's the gravamen of the offense?
Yeah.
Well, I think that it's the public alarm or inconvenience to the public.
What if I stand and yell fire in a movie theater? I haven't violated this, have I?
No, but we'll get you on something else there.
I'm sure.
But I think it's a good point that I don't think you necessarily should limit this to reporting to official agencies. I think the public alarm could result if it was reported to a logging company.
My point is that there's ambulances in the state, for instance, that are privately owned. And hell, if I owned one of those, I'd be just as mad if I was answering false alarms privately as anybody would be publicly.
Yeah, the two reasons they give for this type of legislation, one of them wouldn't apply. That's the waste of government resources. But the second one would, isn't it? Creating situations where personnel and equipment isn't available for real emergencies. And that would apply, of course.
Well, for example, there was in the news a week or two ago in Portland, they have this new unit that they've put together for emergency assistance to heart patients, where it's all going to be self-contained and they can send them out to save heart patients on the scene. And they have all this resuscitation equipment and whatnot. And this wouldn't be a government agency, but as far as the public, and particularly that you're putting this equipment in use needlessly, taking it away from being available for someone who really might need it.
That would be unique, though, wouldn't it? Criminal law. I was talking theory to make it a crime to really interfere that way with the operation.
The bomb threats in the airplane certainly.
Well, as you're talking about, I think there's a distinction there. I'm not arguing against the concept, but I think that's you make a bomb threat in an airplane. There's a clear and present danger to the occupants of that plane. I think if the threat is true or not.
Well, how about only if
that's your fire in a theater.
The evil of yelling fire in a theater is not that you're going to cause public resources to be brought into play.
It's
the danger to the individuals in the theater.
Of course, I think that's true too. As we constantly prove in our neat streets here, that you call out the fire department, and you better get up on the grass.
Well, I was thinking of an ambulance service in Portland that. You see one particular fact, pick it out of the way, they move.
Yeah, well, Tom, let me ask you, isn't it a little unusual? I mean, when we talk about going into the private sector as opposed to the public sector, and we're saying for an individual to obviously do something malicious here, there's usually the civil remedies. When someone does malicious against the private sector, then now we're going to make it a crime.
It disturbs me from the enforceable standpoint. Most of these things are done maliciously, they're done anonymously. I think it's extremely difficult to enforce ever to get a case. And I wonder if I don't have any information as to whether it's a real threat, whether they do get these calls. I have no idea whether it's a practicality that should be legislated against.
We get a number of fire. I don't know about ambulance,
I was thinking about in the private sector.
Oh, fire and Chinese food seem to be the ones you get to. You don't need to put that in the middle.
Underline that for me, please. Mark.
Well, what's your pleasure, gentlemen? We talked all around this one. I'm not too pleased the way it's written. I think it can be written shorter. What did it come from primarily, Raj?
Is it's it New York, isn't it?
No,
well, there are two different. Number one and two really involve two separate things. So the number one, I believe, comes from Michigan. And number two, from New York. In other words, I combined in one section what the other states had in separate sections.
Is our own state statute on fire any better or worse than this? Is that what you're looking at, Don?
No, I was looking at the model penal code on this.
Page 52 has...
Yeah, that particular Oregon statute isn't in the criminal code.
Now, do we agree that we want to extend? I think we're all right on fire, false fire alarms, are we not? Turning in false fire alarms to an official fire department. We go that far. How about extending it to Weyerhaeuser, to somebody else? We want to make that extension. It's a point that Ken brought up.
Yeah, presently we wouldn't cover that because it says order any other government agency that deals with emergencies,
right,
which would seem to limit it to government agencies.
And even our state law, present state law, doesn't cover it either.
Well, this is an experience they're having. I mean, if it's something that's bothering the companies and private ambulances, I think it might be considered, but I have no information as to whether or not it is.
I don't either, but my point bringing up is I just wonder why we differentiate between the governmental and private sector on something like that. Where it's breaking the law if you do it to the public, then you do it to a private organization.
Now, the model penal code doesn't appear to limit it. There, section 241.4 says, a person who knowingly causes a false alarm of fire or other emergency to be transmitted to or within any organization